I'm so tired. This is one of the tiredest I've ever been in my entire life.
That's right. This is your first Comic-Con.
It is my first Comic-Con.
Wow.
Like, you've been doing these for...
I'm a relative newcomer. It's 5 years for me.
A scant 5 years.
Well, I ran into a guy. I was talking with somebody from Legendary, and he's like, this is my 21st contiguous Comic-Con. He's like, I've done way more than that, but I had to miss a year. So he that's where he starts his count.
I don't know if you saw this morning, Congressman John Lewis is here.
You tweeted that night. It's up on my phone right now.
It's so delightful. It's the most delightful. It might be like my favorite convention thing I've ever seen. He's cosplaying as himself from the Selma March.
Oh.
That's what he wore, and he has his backpack from the march. It's like an iconic photo of him.
Oh. Yeah, see that.
Is that not the coolest thing?
That is somebody who I don't even have a word for what that is. That is genuine and like somebody who is not afraid to be playful in it with their own reputation. You know, that is super cool.
Yeah, I'm super into it.
And to do it from 50 years ago, like, that shows an incredibly agile mind to, like, if I am 70 and still kind of, like, goofing around, I will, well, hell, if I make it to 70 at all, I will probably be pretty happy.
How has the convention been? I've been to a couple of your events. I was at a Q&A you did last night. You have, I really admire the... like patience and generosity you have with fans who come talk to you. I feel like you make a tremendous amount of time for people, and you create you're very good at like zeroing in on someone and really listening to them and creating a connection with them.
Well, it helps that I actually genuinely like people. You know, I mean, some people like people, some people don't. I was talking with a teacher friend once, and she said, she was talking about assessing another potential teacher's application. So you have a teacher come in, they teach a guest class. And what she said is, he goes, this guy loves the students and he loves his material. And after that, it's just all craft. You know, it's the craft of pedagogy. And he will do nothing but get better at the craft as you age. So he's like, he has some problems in his class, but you can't learn love, you know, you kind of either start with that or you don't. And I do, I genuinely like people. And I suppose I have probably preemptively overshared, you know, if they read my blog, they know more about my life than many of my friends. If my friends don't read the blog too, you know. I talk about everything because I have just very, very few filters.
I also have to tell the story of that crazy party we went to a couple nights ago on the podcast.
Yeah.
Just as a warning to anyone, to the people listening to this, there's no way I come away from this story not looking like a douche who's going to name drop people, but that's Comic-Con. It's an extremely weird convention. So Pat and I met up on... well, Friday night at the Savage's like tested party where Deadmau5, who's a very loud musician, was playing, and there were so many nice people there, and I could not hear a word that anyone was saying, and I think I'm kind of missing the part of my brain that knows what to do at that type of party.
I think it might be that, you know, at certain points in your life you learn certain skills. Like me, I have like a section of social interaction. I think when you're like 9, 10, 11, you learn how to kind of like playfully, maybe like 12, 13, 14, you know, maybe you learn how to like playfully flirt with the opposite gender. And
can I tell you where I went wrong?
Yeah.
I learned all of the different classes of Federation starships by memory.
Me, I learned Elvish. You know, and so instead of that, like where that should be in my brain, you know, I don't know how to flirt or be playful or like do those things that indicate to somebody that you're interested in, that you are interested in them. And so what happens is, you know, it's at this point, I can learn it, but it's sort of like cooking off of a recipe. It's like, ah, we have spoken for 15 minutes and you haven't looked at your watch. You aren't turning your shoulder toward me to indicate a sort of shunning or a desire for distance from this conversation. This might indicate a non-repulsion on your part. See, it's not an intuitive interaction to me. And so I think it's these sorts of parties, you might, if you grow up and you go to some of these parties and you dig a rave, or it might even be that I think some people psychologically don't have a predisposition for a certain type of party.
Yeah.
And like I was curious, like I'm kind of there's my alarm. I'm supposed to wake up at this point. I'm already awake. You know, I was curious. I was kind of assuming that you're a bit of an introvert.
Well, that's an interesting question. To some extent, I don't know that I feel like those like introvert, extrovert are sort of like natural categories. I've heard one interesting like measure of it is like when you're with people, do you feel recharged or you need to go recharge afterwards? And before I go to be with other people, I mean, I need to psych myself up. I need to know it's coming and have time to prepare and like stand in front of the mirror and be like, you could go talk to people. You're cool. And, you're a cool, good person.
You're smart and you're good and people like you.
Yeah, dang it. So, and then I'm just drained. I mean, doing a convention like this where you're sort of with people from the moment you wake up until the moment you fall asleep is just. What's the thing? Our friend Will Wheaton told me one time. I was like, we were trying to decide. We were like, it was like late one night at a convention. We're like, should we go try and like get drinks and hang out? And Will was like, well, he's like, at this point, I'm all out of mana, and I could start burning health to regenerate mana.
You said
but that's inadvisable, I think.
You said that last night, and I'm like, that is the perfect comparison. Yep. That absolutely defines your choice at a certain point in a con. Yep. How much health am I going to burn for mana? Yeah.
What about yourself? Are you?
You know, I've thought about it for a long time, and a lot of people who meet me assume that I'm an extrovert because I do like people. You know, I obviously am not afraid of the sound of my own voice. I like talking. I like the stage. You know, I like teaching, which is a sort of a stage. And I'm gregarious. You know, I like to talk and meet people. I get that from my mom, actually. My mom would make two friends in the line at the grocery store.
You seem like you get energy. You get like a wind when people want to come talk to you.
And this is it. I think what you brought up, it's like introvert, extrovert. I mean, nobody fits tightly into any box. Any binary is probably a mistake to try to adhere to in any strict fashion. But I think any framework sometimes gives you a good rule of thumb for patterns of behavior, you know? And so I kind of went, well, I guess I do love performance. I do love these things. I'll sign for 10 hours and I'll be completely happy. That must make me an extrovert. But the truth is, I really don't think I am. I stumbled onto sort of a subclassification. People refer to it as the outgoing introvert. And what it is you do enjoy like performance. You do, but you know, I have spent like a week inside my house, not seeing other people, you know, going days without talking and been completely happy. In fact, full of joy from that. I think that is sort of my natural state is solitude, small groups, gatherings, not parties. But the truth is, I do get energy in the moment. If I'm signing books, if I'm meeting people, if I'm doing a Q&A, which I love to do, I am full of energy in that moment because I love meeting people. But afterwards, I pay for it. It doesn't charge me up. It charges a capacitor, not a battery. There we go. There's our analogy.
All right, I got to finish my story because going to tie in really. This is going to be an interesting twist on what you're saying. So we go. So we leave the loud Adam's Loud party, and Pat was like, Felicia invited me to the Legendary party, which is like the parent company of Nerdist and Geek and Sundry, And we sort of wandered around for a little bit, and we found that party, and we went in. And that is unlike any other party I have ever been to, or any really gathering I've ever been to, in that it was people we knew. So it was like, you know, writers and geek friends and stuff. And then actual, literal famous people from my as seen on TV, famous celebrity people.
Yep.
Many of whom recognized you on site and came up to say hello, which was cool.
You know, I got to say, like, I've known Seth Green's wife for a while, and we had lunch and we've chatted. But you know, I ran into him there, and it caught me completely unprepared, which is good. Otherwise I would have like freaked myself out a little bit, but he came and he shook my hand, and I said, I love Robot Chicken, you know, like that fills a place in my heart I never knew needed filling.
Yeah.
And then he was very nice, and I was like, oh shit, I think he knows who I am.
Oh yeah.
And it gave me like a little giggle, you know. I was like, teehee, I got to meet Seth Green.
So at this party, there are, you know, Nathan Fillion was there from Firefly.
Did you see Nathan Fillion?
He was on his way out as we were coming in.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of comedy people. I saw like Kumail Nanjiani. I said hi to. I mean, I'm aware of how this is going to sound to people listening to it. At this point, we're fully in Assholeville.
Well, no. But aware that, like, if you're thinking, oh man, that would have been awesome to be there, that's what we were thinking while we were there.
Yeah. I mean, it was so weird. Like, I was like, what do I do with my hands? I suddenly don't know where my hands go.
Yes.
So on our way, we had a nice time. We saw friends, like we had some drinks. We found like the quiet dark corner and went and hung out with the janitors in the back.
That's my superpower. I can find the quietest place at any park.
It was so nice. And then and there were all these, when we were there, there was whisperings. There was like, oh, Joss Whedon's here. Joss Whedon's on the dance floor. Joss Whedon's here. And I could see Pat. I could see like a little flicker of like panic in your eyes as people were saying this. So we eventually head out. I think it was the end of the party. And we were sort of standing downstairs by the exit of this party, and we were in mid, I don't know, this happens to us all the time where I feel like we're trying to say goodbye and then we talk for another hour.
Yeah.
And we're standing by the doors talking in a full conversation, and I have my back to like the staircase, and all of a sudden Pat's in the middle of a sentence and he just like stops talking and his pupils dilate and your jaw drops and you're just like dumbstruck. And there comes Joss Whedon down the stairs, and I was like, what? I was like, is the president here? What's happening? But it was actually, it was adorable. It was like you were just fully immobilized.
You know, I've had a crazy Comic-Con, and over these last couple of years I've met people who I have admired and venerated. You know, I've gotten to the point where I can email Neil Gaiman, you know, and I don't have to talk to myself in the mirror first, you know, and it's hard to think of a creator I respect more than Neil Gaiman. So I've gotten to that point, but like there is always going to be someone for everyone that you cannot, you respect or you admire so much that you can't deal with it rationally. And like, I could probably meet the Pope. I could probably meet the president, but I've thought about it because, of course, I want to meet Joss Whedon, and I want to tell him that, like, you changed the way that I thought about storytelling. Like, I learned so much about structure from watching what you do. Like, no one masters bathos, you know, the way that you do. I'm upon this rock I will build the church of Joss Whedon, you know, I will be his disciple, and no fire will burn from me the conviction that he is the finest living storyteller, you know, in of our age. And but I saw him, and I wasn't quite ready for it. Well, I don't know if I ever would be. But it did. It completely short-circuited me. And I remember what I said. I don't remember what I was talking with you about. Yeah. But I saw him. And then I realized I was just going, oh, shit. Oh,
that's right.
Shit.
That's right.
Oh, shit. Shit. It's Joss Whedon. Shit. Shit. And it's like, and that was like the only way that I could express the feeling, because it's like,
I think at one point you like turned around in a little circle, like, do I run? Do I stay? Like, what do I do?
Pure animal fear and panic. It was, and you said, well, go talk to him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you don't just go talk to Joss Whedon. Like,
well, I don't, here's my thing. I've learned to be very careful about meeting people whose work I really admire, because yeah. They're not all Pat Rothfuss. Like, a lot of times they're really mean or even worse, they're dumb. Mm. I hate meetings like a like a couple times I've really felt strongly about a musician or an actor or something, and I see them interviewed and they're an idiot, and that's crushing.
Heartbreaker.
It's terrible. Joss Whedon, there's a guy I don't need to disappoint or be disappointed in. Like, it's better. Our relationship is great how it is.
And you're right. And I think that is a truly evolved fan attitude. And that's what I had. I had the opportunity to maybe go and say hello to Patrick Stewart because I just caught him and Ian McKellen doing Waiting for Godot.
Oh, I'm so New York. Mad that you saw that.
I've seen it twice. I saw it once in London and once in New York. And I'm sorry, but I will gloat over that one a little bit. It was so good. And then afterwards, I saw people clustered around the stage door. And I'm like, I wonder if they will come out. Because I know, even at this point in my life, not even a decade in, you know, I can get used up at the end of some of these shows. And it does take... It takes something out of you. First, you do a huge performance. You've got your own busy life. And then if you're going to meet 70 people and sign some stuff and shake hands, it takes more out of you. I mean, it is work. And if even if it isn't work, it's time. And that we all only have so much of that. And so I'm like, are they even, I mean, if I was them, I would maybe be sneaking out the back door, because they've been doing this for ages and they're like Nexa level famous. And they came out, and they did. Now, and they didn't glad hand, and they didn't do selfies, and they weren't joshing around. You could tell it was kind of business, but they were still doing it. It was like a service to their people, these people who loved them. They signed some stuff, and they nodded and smiled. They were tired too, and then they were kind of hustled off. But they gave half an hour, and my sister was with me, and she's like, "Do you want to go get something signed?" And I'm like, you know, I can't do much for them, but like, I can give them the 9 seconds that they would have otherwise spent maybe shaking my hand, which it seems like a small thing, but if many of us get together, we can give Patrick Stewart an hour of his life back. And so, and plus, like you said, it's like, I think our relationship is good. Now, Joss Whedon, here's the conflict for me, where I feel a disproportionate level of debt to him. Like, Patrick Stewart didn't change my life. You know, he has not taught me things about my craft. And for me, you know, that's Joss Whedon. And plus, the truth is, like, suddenly I find myself in the situation where, like, I might desperately need someone who's able to interpret work for, like, the television medium. And
I got to ask you. So can I ask you about this?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Please, okay. Let's talk
so
about
this
that.
So this is here's the multi-million dollar question. I saw the story going around online that there's a bidding war over the, I don't know, film, televisual rights?
It's all the rights.
All the rights.
Yeah.
Of it, and is it the whole series? Is it King Killer?
Everything.
The series?
Everything, yeah.
And that sounds pretty good, a bidding war. That sounds like what you want.
It's the sort of thing that that it's nice when it happens, but you'd be silly to ever suspect would happen.
Mm-hmm.
The rights... we had sold the rights. We took our best shot. You pick your team and you say, okay, and we're going to roll the dice. But, you know, all you gamers out there, you know what happens. No matter how you stack all your modifiers up, it's like you can get a shitty roll. And things just didn't work out. You know, I like the people. I love my writer.
This is a previous attempt.
This is the previous attempt.
Of adapting.
Yeah. Okay. To do it for TV.
Okay.
And the reason I haven't talked about it much online is that either there's no news or there's weird news or it's news that would take so much effort to explain the subtlety of it that all I, even if I tried to tell the story, all it would do is spread misinformation because it's so hard to grasp the whole what's going on. But anyway, so I, those rights reverted like 2 days before Comic-Con.
So previously it was an option, which means, yes. Is that right? Which means someone pays you money and then they can make a TV series or not. And if they don't, you, the rights go back to you and you can do what you want with them.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that is something that we did, that my film agent made happen. He had a very tight time period, you know, an almost abnormally tight time period that he really pushed for because he wanted this to either happen or for us to get the rights back so that we could go do something else. And so the normally you have an option period and then there's the option to renew for a second. But both of ours together was only 2.5 years, which is very short for two option periods. So it reverted, and then I found out that there had been some studios kind of circling like sharks waiting for this to happen. And so he's like, can you meet with a couple people? And I'm like, maybe.
So what do you think, what changed in do you feel like the culture has changed in 2 years where it's like, maybe it's like a, like post Game of Thrones ascendancy?
Game of Thrones has certainly helped. In fact, I think Game of Thrones has been the third thing that's truly broadened fantasy in the minds of the general populace. You had Lord of the Rings, and people are like, oh, okay, that was the unfilmable movie. For ages, it's like Lord of the Rings was the one that nobody could successfully do. And they're like, wow. And, of course, smashing success, huge pop culture saturation. Everyone loves it. And they pull it off. And then... you have Harry Potter. And so it's like, oh, it's like, I might not be able to, it's like, this is kind of weird. He's a, you know, but Harry Potter is very personal. Like anybody can get into that. You know, it's I don't want to say lowest common denominator. That sounds snobbish, but there's a low threshold for entry into the Harry Potter story. Right. It's very, very easy to, for almost anyone to enjoy it.
It gently brings you into a fantasy world without having any expectations on the reader or the film goer.
Yep.
You know, you're going to see like the all story, like the heroic journey,
yeah,
in a very traditional sense.
Yep.
And it's going to be, the exposition's going to move really slowly.
Yeah,
exactly.
You don't have to read 150 pages about the Shire before shit starts to happen. You know.
Right.
But still, it was like, so it's either, it's all wizards, right? It's either Gandalf and you got a sword and a dwarf, or you got goblins and kids and some fictional kind of this goofy, silly, tongue-in-cheek thing. And then Game of Thrones happens, and it's like, oh, there's no wizards at all. And holy wow, there's lots of tits and blood in here. This is like serious drama and awful things happen. And those three things were so different, people are now forced to acknowledge that, wow, fantasy can do everything. It's almost a genre. It is not a thing into itself. You know,
the public has a surprising capacity to become immersed in a world that needs a lot of work to understand.
Yeah, yeah. And the people were willing to go in and do that work for this profoundly adult, you know, and this dark story. And so, yeah, that trail has been blazed at this point in the public mind. Also, my second book came out, you know, and that did very well. It's also, there's just been more time for people to talk to each other about the book or say, oh, have you read this book? You know, if something's on TV, you know, anybody with an hour who can kind of sit down and passively be exposed to it. But books propagate more slowly through the cultural consciousness because you have to pick it up and actively engage in the consumption of it. You can't walk into a room and accidentally read a book because somebody else is reading it. So I think all of those, the fact that I am fairly public, that like I do Acquisitions Incorporated with, you know, Penny Arcade. I do the charity, and that catches some people's eyes.
You do the hit podcast.
Yes.
Untitled Rothfuss podcast.
Untitled Rothfuss.
Yeah.
And I think all of those things have kind of happened. Plus, but the primary mechanism, honestly, is like people giving the book to other people because they like it.
Yeah.
I think that's the big thing that's been slowly happening over the last several years.
I'm sure I've personally responsible for like 50 sales of Name of the Wind.
Actually, I don't doubt it. It's people come to me and they're like, I bought a dozen copies of this. And I'm like, oh, a missionary. Thank you so much. And I do the same thing. Like Ali Brosh, I bought 20 copies of her books and it's changed my entire social circle.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's the big thing that's changed over these last years. And it used to be, anyway, so when my agent told me, he's like, can you take a few meetings? I'm like, you know, if this is important, I can come to LA. And then he says, yeah, we'll schedule some stuff. And then he called back the next day and he's like, so now it's everyone. And I'm like, who do you mean? He goes, actually, literally everyone, like every major studio and most of the other studios want to have a meeting with you. And so it's been, I honestly can't count, but that's all I've done. I've slept, I've eaten, I've done my Comic-Con programming commitments, and I've had meeting after meeting with studio people.
So what are your like emotions around the whole project? Is it intimidating? Is it like, I mean, it must be, I imagine it must be kind of a complicated thing, because it's the, in one sense, it's like the, it's like the ultimate appreciation of your work that someone wants to spend a ton of money and bring it to the public. And in the other, it's like a real loss of control because there's going to be a director and a showrunner and people playing in your sandbox.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, I knew there's so many things that can go wrong. There's 10,000 ways a production can go wrong and probably about 10 ways they can go right. And so that means just the odds are not great for getting a really great show.
Not a great modifier on those dice.
Right. And then you can go like, well, oh, we've got a really great writer attached. You know, that's plus four. You know, but you're still dealing with like a 10,000, you know, 1 to 10,000 randomization factor. But the weird thing is, you're right. Like the loss of control is a horrifying thought for me because this is my world. It's my baby. I've poured a lot of time and energy and love into this thing over 20 years. Now, Sanderson, you know, who's on the opposite end of the spectrum from me, but who I love as an author, has like a bunch of different properties. And so it's like, want to do Mistborn? He's like, I don't doubt that he experiences the same anxiety of giving it away, but he has like four other worlds and properties. So if one of them just ends up like a tire fire, he's got other stuff. Whereas this is my tangible soul I have here.
It's a legacy at this point.
Well, and honestly, I don't want to like grab a big suitcase full of money, roll around in it and have like my 10 million readers weep tears of despair.
Well, let me ask you a question. Like, let's say I don't really know how much money you get paid if your TV show gets picked up, but let's say it's like, you know, millions of dollars, $10 million,
right,
that you make tomorrow. How does your life change?
You know, it's, I'm not entirely sure either. I know what happens as soon as Hollywood starts producing and promoting a show based off a book, of course, your book sales triple, quadruple, you know, they go up by a factor of 10.
Are you going to issue a reprint with the actors on the cover?
That would probably only be sensible, you know, assuming it's a good thing that happens. But so in some ways,
as long as Doors of Stone matches the other two that I have, do you understand what, do you know what I mean?
I do. You have to have matching books.
Thank you.
That's no, there's no question about that.
Thank you.
And my publisher,
it's going to drive me nuts. I'm going to have to rebuy them.
Yep. Oh, yeah. See, there's our marketing strategy right there.
Right.
No, that's it. My editor would not do that to you. She respects you too.
Okay.
But anyway, the truth is, I mean, it would be like somebody taking out a $1 million ad campaign for my book. And that means more people experience my book, which is nice. And nobody can ever ruin my book. My book will always be there. It is inviolate, you know? Now that said, I feel like I owe it to my people and to my book and to myself to stack the deck as much as possible in terms of making something which I am proud of and which is beautiful. Now, if I make something beautiful and it fails, I sleep well at night, and I am delighted. And that was always my strategy with Name of the Wind. I never expected it to be published. I knew it wouldn't be, probably. So I just made the best book I could that I loved, and I did all sorts of things wrong, against the rules that you shouldn't do in fantasy. But I'm like, this is what I want to do. I want it to be this. And I got lucky in that people seemed to be ready for it. So, but as you mentioned, the money, at this point, I mean, I live in central Wisconsin. I don't have a thing for fast cars. I cannot tell you the last time I bought clothing that was not like a geek t-shirt online. You know, what am I going to do with $10 million? You know, I would put it in my charity, and that's nice for charity. But I don't really, you know, money isn't a huge motivator for me, which is nice because that gives me the ability to walk away from the table at any point. Because you know what I want? I want to make a TV show. I want when my books hit the screen, whether it's a TV screen or the movie screen, oh God, I could actually feel my caffeine just kicked in. You know, it's like, here's what I want. My power is upon me now. Here's what I want, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I want like people with their own faces. I want people, not just a bunch of folks in here who are Hollywood pretty, not just a bunch of people in there that are like flavor of the day. You know, I don't want a bunch of people. I want actors. I want people in there that like, that sell it, you know, like Edward Norton quality actor. I want fucking Danny Kaye in there. Some people who actually know the craft.
But to be honest, I think you need that to tell the story.
Absolutely.
Because there, it's not a story that can lean on effect sequences or action sequences. I mean, you need actors who will sell the shit out of it.
Exactly. Because it's centered around a story.
Yeah.
You know, but that also means, you know, and the world has a lot to offer. The exploration of the world is one of the joys of secondary world fantasy. So, like people like Guillermo del Toro, they get that. And so, like, they'll make a movie and they're like, look at this beautiful world. You know, look at this. It's very rich. But here's the other thing. You know, it's like, I want good body type stuff going on in my show. I want a bunch of women who are beautiful with different shaped faces and bodies. Not just, you know, all these people look the same. Not these conventionally, you know, what Vogue says a beautiful woman is supposed to be, dressed up in different ways. I want, you know, I need, like, I want black people in my movie, you know, because yeah, I need people to come to grips with the fact that the Childish folk are fucking black. They are black as black. And, you know, I don't make a big point out of it. I mention their skin color. But, like, the university is a fucking diverse place. People from Modag look dusky. You know, they look like Brazilian. You know, that's what they're like. I want that.
That's so different than what you hear from a lot of fantasy stuff, which is, oh, well, it's a fantasy setting, so it's all white people.
Yeah.
Because historically, that's how it was.
It's Europe in the Middle Ages. But Europe in the Middle Ages was full of ethnic diversity, you know, and they've proven it. And the reason people don't think it's true is because you have fucking TV shows that's just cast with whoever happens to be in Hollywood, which happens to be a bunch of white people, because it's safest, because that's who they market to. But and all of that is like a bunch of silly little side things. But this is like, this is my dream list, right? This is me, like, what do I want? Here's what I want. And I also want, like, I want this story to have room to breathe. I want to actually be able to portray complex human relationships. I want somebody involved who realizes that you can break somebody's heart without killing a character. Because honestly, Martin has played that game better than anybody else, you know? And he has won that game. That is not my book. Because every successful big budget fantasy thing that has ever been done so far has been plot driven or action driven. And my book is neither plot or action driven.
Would you say it's a milieu book?
My book is an irreconcilable ganglion of antithetical factors. That's my pitch. But, you know, I was in a meeting the other day, and I've done so many of these, and I got caffeinated again, and I spent 40 minutes arguing with this person, like pounding on the table, explaining to him why you could never make a good movie out of my book, which I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure that's not how you're supposed to handle a meeting with a studio exec. you know, I practically drew him a picture of why it wouldn't work. And I love the fact that he argued with me, and he made some really good points, and it showed me that, like, dude actually knew what made the book work. You know, he wasn't a suit that had been given a list of bullet points and came out here. Dude has read it. He gets it.
I'm curious, what are the reasons? There's one big one that sticks out to me, actually, which is, you know, from the setup, from the initial setup of the series, that Kvothe is alive. He's troubled, but he's alive. So whenever he's in mortal peril, it lets some of the air out of that tension, because you know he makes it through. And it's an amazing feat of storytelling how much your pulse still races, because you've given him these very specific fears of his hands being damaged, his very few prized possessions being taken from him.
And that's the conventional thought process. And, you know, honestly, a lot of writers get into it, too. It's like you need to threaten somebody's life or else. But here's the thing, and it's very sensible. It seems very reasonable. But if the best tension came from fear of the protagonist's death, nobody would ever read a book twice. You don't walk into Oedipus Rex going, oh, wow, I wonder what's going to happen. You go in there going, he's going to kill his dad and fuck his mom and gouge his eyes out, and I want to see it happen.
Yeah, spoilers.
Spoilers. Sorry, it's only been like 3,000 years for Oedipus Rex. I was a little early on that one. So, you know, but here's the thing, and you're right, you can get some tension through that sort of sensation of peril, but that is only if the bludgeon you're going to use is like, oh my God, they could die. But there are so many other ways. It's harder. And one of the things I'm most proud of is it's easy to kill somebody and break their heart, break your heart as the reader. But it's like, I will break your heart because somebody's shirt got ruined.
I've stopped myself reading the books at like numerous points, and I've been like, how could I care so much how many made-up coins this made-up guy has? Yeah. But I do. I care so. I'm like double-checking his math. I'm like, is it going to add up? Like,
I had somebody say that they were rereading the book, so they've already read it more than once, and they got to the point where he was about to go in and Ambrose, spoiler alert, right, where Ambrose is tricking him into, like, selling him a candle.
Right.
So not just setting him up to get banned from the archives, but actually charging him money to do it.
Piece of shit.
And so he's doing it, and the person, they said, I had to stop. I couldn't read anymore that day because I was so angry. I was going to be so hurt for Kvothe. And what the tragedy is there, yeah, he gets whipped, but that isn't what breaks your heart. That isn't what breaks your heart. Like, it's the fact he loses some money. It's the fact that Ambrose gets the better of him. That's not even it. All of those are conventional things, and they work to my advantage. I use them. What breaks your heart is this boy who wants nothing more than to get into the archives for his whole life, and he can't. It's like, I will break your heart over a fucking library card. And I need a showrunner. I need a director. I need a writer who gets that. And you know, here, this is what I know. And that means I want Joss Whedon. Yeah. You know, hello, Hollywood, all of the studio people, if you happen to have tuned into this podcast.
Joss, I know you're listening.
And you've listened for, you know, an hour of me ramble and rave. Here's the thing. I don't need money. Right? I've got money. My family is okay. My kids are, I'm going to probably send them to a state school, so I don't need $1 billion for that.
There still is one in Wisconsin.
If there is still one in Wisconsin in a couple of years. So here's what I want, right? If you bring me Joss Whedon and he's willing to work on me with this show, you do not need to pay me money.
Oh, don't say that. Nope. I'm going to edit that out.
No, nope. You leave that in. You leave that. That
all
is
right,
my
here's
deal.
Here's the deal. All the producers listening, I know they all listen. All the producers listening to this, you pay me. Pat's not going to take it. I'll take it.
It's like, you know.
You pay me half. How about that?
Max, yeah. Go get me Joss Whedon, right? And you can have my piece of the action.
Yeah.
You know, you can, I will sign over, I'll keep the merchandising. How about that? You know?
Okay. Get the George Lucas move. You make the toys.
Well, yeah. And I give all the merchandising rights to World Builders. So that's, I don't want to take that away from them. But no, listen to me. I am serious here. If you want to make this deal happen, you know, it's like, I'm not in this for the money. I would like to make something beautiful. And if we make something, and the best way I can think to stack the deck is to take somebody who, if they make changes to my book, I trust them implicitly as a creator. And there is no one that I know of whose work I have followed, whose every interview I have read that has like rung a bell in my heart like Joss Whedon. So if you bring him in, you know, and it's like, I will do that. I will sign that contract. Or Joss, you know, if you happen, somebody turns you onto this podcast, like I'll just give you the movie rights. I'll sell them to you for a penny. It'll be all yours. Do whatever you want with them.
Forever. So now I'm suddenly nervous to like say anything on the podcast. Firefly, hell of a show.
Oh man, I will never be over Firefly.
Heartbreaker.
That's a heartbreaker. It's something beautiful that didn't work out, and it will be beautiful forever. That is what I want to do. You know, and here's the thing. I know that from the interviews, I know that he is exhausted from Avengers. I know that he fought to tell the story that he wanted to tell, and he was opposed constantly, you know, forces arrayed against him that were mighty and powerful, and he did his best, and you can see like the platonic form of Avengers shining through the movie, and there's these moments of Joss Whedon brilliance scattered through there. You know, it's like, I'm not going to fight you, you know? Well,
so let me be the skeptic for a minute. On the Kingkiller, you know, film. So Joss Whedon makes literally the most the biggest grossing movie of all time, right. The Avengers, right?
It's second now.
Jurassic Park. But, yeah. Well, what can you do?
Yeah.
At the time, the biggest grossing movie of all time, right? And he is recognized as like an auteur. You know, he's not just some guy. Like, he's put in the work. He's done this as a repeatable process. He's a bankable, great director with an all-star cast. If that guy cannot go into the studio and make the superhero movie he wants, how do you go make? How do you make sure that the book adaptation is the adaptation you want?
Well, here's the thing. First off, I'm not married to the idea of a movie. Okay. Honestly, it's like the movie money is way better than TV money. But I'm not in this for the money. So, my film agent is probably going to be really pissed that I'm saying all this on a podcast. First off, in answer to your question, Joss Whedon obviously was beloved. They trusted him. They wouldn't have brought him in to do it again otherwise. But they, you know, Marvel and the studios, they are these monolithic beasts, and they're orchestrating all of these other movies, and they're saying, you need to put this in so that it ties in here. So, I mean, Marvel itself as a media creating entity, you know, is going to force certain corporate things because they have an agenda. It's like, here's the thing. It's like, there's no tie-ins here. There's no obligations. There's no brand licensing franchise manager looming over us like Sauron, you know, like his shadow has grown long, you know? And so here you could come in and like make a show with me, do for straight up fantasy what you did for urban fantasy before it was a genre with Buffy. Let me show off like some strong women. Let me show this real world, but let's do it in a fantasy world that's like straight up secondary world where the emphasis is on characters and relationships. You know, it's like you show, I mean, yeah, I'm this is weird. I'm writing a love letter to Joss Whedon on this podcast. Max, you have to attest to the fact that I don't have just one coffee in front of me. I actually have two coffees.
It's an array of coffees. I'm going to take before we're done, I'm going to take a picture of this scene and I'll put it in the show notes so people can see. It's kind of a silly scene. We're like sitting in this like hotel courtyard and we've got this like all the microphones in front of us.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, it was said to me at one point, it's like there's enough interest and enough people fighting over this that we could say, you know, bring in a great director. And that's what made me think. And so people said, you know, Nolan, you know, we could have them try to bring in Nolan, you know, these other or whomever. You know, but it's silly to think of. But that's the dream. That's the dream for me, is somebody who I can trust creatively. So if he makes a change, because changes will happen, but I would trust that his changes would be to good purpose.
So let me ask you a couple other questions about the whole process.
Yeah.
So Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin usually typically writes one episode in this. I mean, he's some sort of producer, right?
Yeah.
He's involved in sort of shaping the story because at some point has to line
a lot
up.
Of times you can just get producer credit by demanding it and they pay you as a producer. But then there are like producers who actually do things. There's producers who are.
How do you know all this? Is this, you've had like a crash course?
Yeah, I've crash course over these last several years and these last several days in particular. I have asked a lot of questions. It's like exploring a different country suddenly. I've been dropped in Patagonia, and I'm having to learn what the poisonous snakes look like.
Yeah. So George R. R. Martin writes like one episode, but usually like the penultimate episode. I think he writes all that. Not this season though, but in previous ones. Is that hold any interest for you?
Writing
on the show or you know, writing on the film?
Megalomaniacal as I might be. I'm not yet arrogant enough to think that I can master the art of screenplay writing, through a sheer act of will. Because Martin has worked in Hollywood for ages. Like, he knows that writing. I would love to help shape the story. I would love to, you know, if they would be open to it, I would love to write some of the screenplay with the assistance of a pro, because that medium is foreign to me, and I'm not arrogant enough to think that I could just suddenly pick it up. But you know, honestly, I would love a chance to like take a pass through and like tweak and fiddle a little bit, you know, and say, oh, this will make it sound more like Ari. You know, it's like I can add a little bit of dialogue. But knowing how to shape and massage and cut these scenes, it's like that's not a part of my brain yet. Maybe after a season or two, you know, I would get it. But right now, I know that I am not the best man for that job. Person for that job.
And how does all this fit into your writing? Because like I know we've also talked a lot about we both have this propensity to like start a lot of projects and think big and. You know, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse.
Here's the thing. Right now, we're having this storm of attention where, right now, and I don't know, other people have called this a bidding war, so I suppose that's something I'm comfortable repeating. So right now, in this moment,
it's one of the top kinds of wars.
It's a pretty good kind of war. Of all my wars, this is one that I can support.
Of all the wars that could happen to you, it's top 10 for sure.
Top 10. Maybe top 3.
Yeah.
But right now, in this moment, the stars have aligned, and that gives me power to potentially negotiate a much better deal and to stack the deck. So the question is, if I do want to do a movie ever or a TV show ever, this is the time when I will be able to like line up all my modifiers to before I roll those dice. So this is a good time to do it, which isn't to say that I'm not afraid of walking away entirely, but this is a good time. Maybe not the best time, but it's certainly far better than we suspected that we were going to have. Now, and truthfully, my main concern isn't that it might, delay the book. My real concern is that it might destroy my life. But you know, it might throw my life into a certain amount of chaos. But if it is my best chance to make, you know, the Firefly version of my book, it's like I would feel bad not even considering that possibility. So that's what I'm doing right now, is I'm considering that possibility.
Do you have a concern that the just the intensity of you know doing some sort of TV or movie adaptation like ruins the fun of the world for you? Like that it becomes, how do I say it? That it becomes like too big. I felt that with Cards, where it's like, it's too big to work on. Like it's now it's,
oh, it right, belongs to so many people.
Now it's Cards Against Humanity. Like who am I to write a joke for Cards Against Humanity? Right.
that's really interesting hearing coming from you at this point. You know, I won't say it's hard, but there is like a weight of responsibility. You know, it's part of this is for me because I love my world and my characters, but the most of it is because this book is really important to a lot of people.
So I'm not going to ask you about this every week, but how do people know what happens? I mean, so at some point there'll be like a decision on this.
You can probably safely assume that for the next month, there will be a lot of talking going on in the Rothfuss compound. You know, this is our moment, but it is not a moment in time like, you know, oh, it's the summer solstice and we must perform our ritual before the sun sets. It's tempting to think of it like that, and it kind of feels like that. It's like, oh, I've got to make a deal before the end of Comic-Con. But no, I know that's silly. My philosophy is always, if you're going to do it, you want to do it right. And that usually takes some considered thought and some real negotiating. And honestly, I'm going to talk to a lot of people. I've been lucky enough to make friends who know Hollywood and have no reason to lie to me. And so I'll call them and I say, so what do we know about these people? What do you think about this? Clue me in, because they know more about the landscape than I do.
Who are the guys who are, do you think, are best at navigating this?
What do you mean?
I mean, we have a lot of friends who have done like TV, you know, made deals or put stuff into production. Like who knows? I mean, who's the best at this?
For me, like honestly, one of my go-to people for like almost anything is John Scalzi. You know, like something happens with books, you know, and I call John. You know, something happens with video games, I call John. Something going, you know, happens like in the community, you know, and I'm like, Jesus, I don't know what to make of this. I call John. He's also done television consulting. He's got two movie deals of his own in the works. So he's like ahead of me on this path. And so I kind of watch him. And he's very nimble. He doesn't hit landmines, so I watch where he stepped. And I can call him and say, God, this is happening. Am I weird to think this? And he just gives me, he's a touchstone. Will Wheaton is also very gracious, and he said, call me and ask me. And through him, I've met some other folks, that I can use as touchstones too.
It sounds like that's pretty much who you want on your team figuring this out.
Yeah,
that's the dream team.
Yeah.
All right. Let's. We got to do our follow up question and see if we have to give $100 to Scott Walker. Did you use an alarm?
I did.
How did it go?
Well, it's a little tricky because we finished the podcast and then there were
We've been traveling all
week. We might need to, but I did. I plugged it in. I used it for the 2 days. It was good. I have been keeping the phone out of the bedroom, so like I have to get up and at least, you know, go out, and that is good. Even just being aware of the fact that it has a potentially deleterious effect on the start of my day makes me mindful of the fact that I might want to push it off until after I've like had a glass of water. As opposed to it being the first thing you consume before even like practically air.
Totally.
How about you?
It's been going well. I kind of hate the alarm clock that I got. It has like a really piercing, upsetting noise. So that needs some work. But yeah, I've been at home. I've been plugging my phone. I have the Apple Watch. That's another like buzzy, beepy thing that tells me all the things that are exploding in my life. So I've been plugging those in at my desk, and like even in the hotel room at Comic-Con, I have that up like plugged by the front door where you come into the room, and then I'm across the room in the bed. So it's like I have a couple minutes in the morning to like settle in and just like be in the world before I like, go on Twitter and see what's wrong in my life that day.
Yeah. Yeah. How about the, have you put any thought into the scheduling, like what you want to do with your time in your life, because you've got better metrics than you do because you've been tracking these things for longer.
Yeah. So the one I was working, I mean, I'm using the rescue time thing, so that's a freebie for me. So I started I've been sort of thinking a lot about what do I want my time to look like what counts as a good day, what do I want my week to look like, and the thing that I've come up with, but you know, because of all this travel, I haven't had time to enact in any way. My girlfriend and I we're watching The Wire. It's the eighth time I've seen it, but it's her first time through it, and it's really nice because almost every day we set aside 1 to 2 hours and we sit there and we watch an episode of The Wire and we talk about it, and you know, our phones aren't on, we're not doing other stuff. It's just this nice time, this common thing, this nice time together, and then this thing that we can really take apart and talk about afterwards. And that we're nearing the end of The Wire. We're just about to start season 5, so that's something I want to keep going. And you know, I think maybe it'll be making reading time, or you know, just having those structured activities where it's I am putting this on my calendar. It's sacrosanct. I'm not going to do 8 things. I'm just gonna have that moment.
You know, and that's one of the big. Are you talking about specifically relationship time with her?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
And you know, that's one of the big ones because I have made a point of carving out time for my kids, and I need to. You know, one of the things that I should do is try to commit to a certain amount of writing time every day because I tend to be a binge writer, which has worked to me to date. But the problem with binge writing is that, you know, it's easy to put off, you know, because it's like, oh, I can write 16 hours tomorrow if I really want to. But then tomorrow I've got email and whatever. And so I'm like, well, I'll write 2 16-hour days on Thursday and Friday. So that's one thing is I maybe to start slower into a process like Scalzi's where he wakes up. And in the morning, he either does 4 hours or 1,000 words. And once he hits either one of those marks, he stops.
I mean, that's certainly the dream. I mean, I work in a similar way of a sprint, a last-minute panic and then a sprint. But I worry, and I have that fantasy, too, of now I'm really going to get it together and get on a schedule and do my work, you know, in regular increments. But I worry that it's I'm too old. That pathway that's my brain now.
Well,
I got to work with what I have.
It could be. I like to think, God, if you're too old, then I'm well and proper fucked. But the
it's like those grooves get worn into the record, man. You know?
Yeah, I know. But here's the other thing. So I want some of that. But honestly, what is more important to me at this point in my life is just what you said. I need to set aside time to spend with Sarah, not the family. I spend time with the family. I need to set aside time just for Sarah, for us to watch a movie, for us to be people together, not just parents, you know, not just problem solvers in the household. Because, you know, to be completely honest, our relationship has been varying shades of rocky for a while. And I know, and she's extraordinarily important to me. And so it is an asinine process to not prioritize time with her. And thinking about this has made me realize that if I am not willing to set aside a weekend, you know, a night a week for date night, to watch a movie, to you know, just hang out, you know, and to spend time with her, just us. That is, it's ridiculous.
Isn't it crazy how it's when something needs to go, when things get crazy, because it's like, for me, it's always my own fault that I get crazy, right?
Yep.
So I've no one to blame but myself, and the first thing to go is time with Veronica, and it's like, well, she'll understand. It's like the person who's literally always there for me and cares about me the most, she'll get it. I'll blow her off.
Exactly.
How fucked up is that?
It's because we're from the Midwest. I think it is a Midwestern thing where if you think about it, if you bump into someone on the sidewalk, you say, oh, I'm sorry. You know, the less you know someone, the more polite you are to them, right?
Right.
And then and then your friends, you can be kind of crabby ass with them because they're your friends. They get it. And then your family, you can be downright mean to your family. And then the person you love most is the one who you can come home and you just vomit bile from your day into your home. You shit in your own bed, effectively. And my dad used to talk about it, and he goes, isn't this weird? And I'm like, yeah, that is kind of weird. But you're right. It's that might be excusable so long as we are careful to like actually schedule time to be good to each other. I think that's my primary goal, even before I try to fix my work schedule to align with Scalzi's.
Yeah.
Because if I'm able to, you know, maintain or mend some of the problems in my relationship with Sarah, that will have like just immense, like rippling out effects, good effect in my life.
It's a fundamental self-care thing too.
Yeah.
It really is. It's hard to have empathy for other people and be funny or communicate well if you're in pain.
Yeah,
and that unease in the relationship, like no, that's the most painful.
I mean,
that's just brutal.
It does, especially if you work out of the home like I do, and so we'll spend our because she's stay at home mom, I, you know, work at home dad, and we'll go through sometimes a whole day, and we'll say 100 words to each other, and maybe half of those are snippy. You know, it's like, that's not a good scene. And she just deserves better than that.
What are we going to pick? What's our thing for next week?
What's our thing for next week?
Should we make some special time for our special lady friends?
I think that is the deal. That's what we got to do. We'll set a middle ground because I've been thinking it would be good. You were saying once a day.
Yeah.
I was thinking we should do like once a week. Let's say twice. Set aside time just for this. Like no phones, no kids. Twice a week. And, like, if you can beat it, huzzah for you. But I'm going to hold myself to 2, which is way more than I normally do.
All right.
Okay.
And why poor, Rafe?
I am poor in the essence of happiness, lady. Rich only in never-ending unrest. In me there meet a combination of antithetical elements which are at eternal war with one another. Driven hither by objective influences, thither by subjective emotions, wafted one moment into blazing day by mocking hope, plunged the next into the Cimmerian darkness of tangible despair, I am but a living ganglion of irreconcilable antagonisms. I hope I make myself clear, lady.
Perfectly.